welcome to the Court of Appeals in a virtual method here for December 17. This is the third of three oral arguments that we're conducting via Zoom today. Judges Gaetis and Rodenberg are joining me, Judge Sleater, in this third matter. I will note for the record the file number is A21251, the welfare in the matter of the welfare of the child of TDS, the Commissioner of Human Services, the legal custodian in the matter. And counsel, in a few moments, you'll note, you do see the white box where it says Marshall, that will be the time clock. So hopefully you can see that fine. Appellant will have 15 minutes per usual. Respondents counsel 15 minutes in response, and then 5 minutes of rebuttal time for appellant's counsel. We do ask that you identify your full name for our record. We are recording this proceeding in the usual way, and hence any other recording by others, specific, I'm referring to participants who are otherwise listening or watching, because it'll be on the court's website, and any other recording in any method is prohibited. And so, counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and proceed. Thank you. You'll have to unmute yourself, Mr. Fiddler. I saw your lips moving, but we saw the red mark.
I can't wait till this is over.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah. May it please the court, Your Honor. My name is Mark Fiddler, and I represent AM, the appellant in this matter. And
now I did see that, but you may continue.
Yeah, and the guardian ad litem I see is trying to gain access. Is somebody going to let her in?
We can just pause a moment. Very good. Thank you. The guardian litem is now available as well. You may continue, Mr. Fiddler.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, we're here today to ask this court to reverse the order of the court below, denying appellant the right to a trial on her motion for adoptive placement. And just by way of context, I wanted to let the court know that our firm and other family law firms have been litigating these issues for years under the current statute. And there was a very dramatic change that came with Ms. McIntyre's case when we suddenly started seeing a new test being applied that had not hitherto been applied. And we're here today to argue that an error of law has been made and that the court applied the wrong test for unreasonableness in determining whether a prima facie case of unreasonableness has been established. So what the court did, Your Honor, was state a dictionary definition. And you'd think, well, if it comes out of the dictionary, well, that must be clear enough. But the dictionary definition that the court cited had three different phrases that all have different meanings in administrative law, I know. Judge Sheehy cited the Black's Law Dictionary. Unreasonable is not guided by reason. That's one test. Irrational or capricious. And there's a disjunctive or in there. So there's three different tests that are applicable. And this reasonableness language we submit is patently ambiguous because it provides no context for determining what is reasonable. So not guided by reason as to what, to do what? Irrational in terms of what? Capricious in terms of what? So we think, I'd argue that this language is patently ambiguous and that reason, irrational, and capriciousness are all words that are only defined in context. And I think I cited in my brief other definitions of reasonableness that came right out of Black's. And there are 562 instances where reasonableness was measured by some other statute. And that's what we think has to be done in this case. So for instance,
Mr. Fiddler, can I ask you, Mr. Fiddler, do we need to get to the definition if under these circumstances, as I understand it, there was no actual affidavits submitted by the agency, how do we know what the reason was such that it is unreasonable? It dovetails into maybe a broader question I have about use of court's previous findings and reports for context. Right. I'm assuming that means something other than the actual factual reason for denying the placement. We have nothing in the record to look at, if I understand correctly, to determine whether it was reasonable or unreasonable. Am I correct in that?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And we raised that point in our brief that there was no affidavit to show why and how the county came to the decision that it made. And so what the county did do was they wrote a memorandum of law. And in the memorandum of law, they said, you know, we really considered this argument, the best interest, very seriously, and we just came to a different result. Well, those are conclusory statements of counsel argued in a responsive memorandum. So there is no contrary allegations. And the other issue.
Can I just interrupt you? I think one thing that's causing some confusion to me is how what you're saying relates to the sort of burden shifting process that applies in such a petition, where the burden is initially on the foster parent to make a prima facie case showing unreasonableness. So, you know, given that requirement, is the agency required to put anything in? And then if not, how is a court supposed to evaluate reasonableness? And I know that your argument is that it necessarily encompasses the best interests of the child, but with that aside, how do you reconcile the fact that foster parent has a burden? And yet, you know, reasonableness then has to be somehow assessed only in light of one side of the story.
Right, right. Well, that's a very fair question, Your Honor. I know where the court's coming from. I guess what I would do is analogize it to a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. And I just had this case at the Supreme Court, TGG, where the court, you know, there was a paternity complaint filed, and the court said, okay, in a paternity complaint, you know, we have to assume the truth of what's alleged and only one side. And we had, I represented the adoptive parents. We had a very different opinion, but those are issues for trial, not to be considered at the preliminary stage. And so the prima facie test construct that we're looking at here is really analogous to like a motion to dismiss test. So is when you look only at our complaint, have we stated a prima facie case of unreasonableness? And we were always told by the court in prior cases, this is not a high bar to meet. There's nothing new about this. I mean, prima facie means what, like more than a little evidence or something. You know, it's a low bar. And so, you know, if the county does dispute, I mean, obviously the county disputes our position, and they've got some arguments to be made about, you know, the merits of the relative petition, but those are not issues to be decided at this stage. And I think what happened in this case is the court really wanted to get into the merits of the case and did so at a stage that is only designed to determine, is this to separate the wheat from the chaff, is this a serious enough case to merit a trial? Does that address your question, Your Honor? So it'd be like if I was in a criminal trial, I'm the prosecutor. So if I were to tell the jury, you have to find reasonable doubt, but I didn't give you the elements of the crime. You know, it's the same test here. So reasonableness always points to some collateral test. So the court, ironically, said, well, we can only look at reasonableness. And the county said, you can only look at the word reasonableness in the language as plain. But yet, when the county defined why they were reasonable, What did they do? They referred to another statute entirely. So they referred to the relative search requirement under 260C221. So if reasonableness is sufficient unto itself, how do we ever talk about other statutes in the juvenile code? I think that's a very uncompelling argument. So yet we try to argue that the overarching best interest of the child standard in 260C221, 260C212 sub 2B. So there's the 11 best interest factors. You know, we mentioned those and all of a sudden those are not relevant because you only can look at reasonableness per se, but yet they did the same thing by talking about the relative search requirement. So we think the county and the court are just trying to have it both ways.
Mr. Fidler, getting back to both our review and the process, and that is we looked de novo as to whether the court presumes the affidavit motion to be true, and then the abuse of discretion, whether to deny the hearing. And what is your interpretation of the court's order as it relates to your client's affidavits? Do you believe the judge found on the face of the affidavits without even regarding anything from past court orders or court reports that might infer what the agency's position is, because again, we don't have a actual formal response from the agency, that on the face of the affidavit, it's unreasonable? Is that what we're reviewing, in other words? You understand my question? I'm following it with Judge Gaitis. On the other hand, if the court found it reasonable, did the court somehow shift and felt, on the other hand, when in context of past agency reports and court's findings, that it's no longer reasonable?
Yeah, I don't think the court properly credited the appellant's affidavit at all, because the statute says that the court is supposed to deem the affidavit to be true and not look at any contrary allegations. And the other specific thing this court held is to not weigh the evidence. And so what the court did was it went outside of the pleadings entirely and looked at disputed facts that were found in the court record. And there were a few facts that were never litigated or resolved. The guardian ad litem said that the child's hair was not groomed in a culturally appropriate manner. The court found that the relative search was deficient without trial, and used this as rebuttal. The court found that the guardian ad litem supported placement with the relative. That's rebuttal evidence. And by the way, all of these facts were vigorously disputed. I mean, the county itself stood up two or three times and said that they had done an adequate relative search. And the only reason the search was inadequate was because the father had concealed information about who his relatives were. So, you know, so we can go back and forth, but those are really, really trial issues. And if you look at Rule of Evidence 201, this is totally improper reliance on facts, judicially noticed facts that are in dispute. And we think what the court did was, so the county says, well, we don't have to worry about that because it was only providing context. So ask this. So if the context lends weight to the other side, doesn't that mean that the court's doing precisely what this court said it's not supposed to do, that it's weighing the evidence? And, you know, the court, the county, they may not like it, but I think there has to be predominant and exclusive weight put on the appellant's position, and then say, okay, just like if I'm looking at a paternity complaint, I may think the guy's a deadbeat, that he's be a terrible custodian, but that's not the point at this stage of proceedings. Does the complaint state a prima facie case?
Mr. Fidler, along those lines, I'm wondering if you could give me your most concise statement about how the agency was unreasonable, how the decision making of the agency was unreasonable.
I think it's unreasonable because in order to make a placement in the first place, so we couldn't file an adoption petition without the child being placed with my client by the commissioner. And the commissioner and the county and my client all had to sign an adoptive placement agreement. And that can only be entered into after the county has exhaustively considered all the best interest factors and found that placement with the petitioners in the child's best interests. So we come to the court with a presumption of reasonableness, a presumption that the placement is in the child's best interests. And I think we leave it right there. It's unreasonable per se for the county to yank a child where the child has been with the parent for all but 4 months of his 4 years of life, and then to say that is somehow reasonable. Now, and I want to reiterate and make this really clear, you know, we are not saying that the relatives is unsuitable, that maybe arguably placement with the relative is in the child's best interest, but you would never know by looking at the pleadings below. And that's why this case has to go to trial.
Okay. And so if I could maybe paraphrase you, you're suggesting that there is a prima facie case of unreasonableness in a situation where a child has been with a foster parent for 4 years, and then there's a course change.
Yeah, and I would add on to that the fact that it has the imprimatur of the commissioner's stamp of approval. I mean, the Commissioner of Human Services herself approved this. And, you know, it's such a dramatic departure from ever since 1965, you go back to Fleming, the best interest of the child has always been the test until this case came up. And we think the court has to reverse the opinion of the trial court below. And I see my time's up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fidler, and counsel for responding. If you would identify yourself, then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Mary Lynch. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney representing the Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department. The appellant's argument requires this court to ignore the statutory framework, which is within the context of best interest. It's a somewhat unique statutory framework. It is specifically designed to address issues of best interest and to provide a venue or a process for oversight of the department's actions on behalf of the commissioner. So the framework is very clear, and the district court appropriately focused on whether or not the department was unreasonable. Appellant stated facts in her case that could have supported a finding that it was reasonable to place with her, but that does not make the department's decision to make a different placement unreasonable.
What about the argument that appellant is making that there's sort of a presumption of unreasonableness just, based on the facts of this case alone, the fact that this child was placed with this foster parent for 4 years, and there was then a course change after the department had placed its stamp of approval on this foster parent. Can you address that?
Excuse me, I'm sorry, Your Honor. The department did, I mean, it is accurate. The department entered into an adoption placement agreement with appellant. However, that whole train of thought ignores the robust court oversight process that the statute provides to the district court to review progress towards adoption. And into that process is built continuing consideration of a whole variety of factors, and particularly including, in this case, relative placement considerations. So the context of this case, which is relevant without making recourse to facts that need to be weighed, the context, and it's in appellant's affidavit to the extent that it needs to be considered significantly, are that there were different court orders through the course of the case that did focus on relative placement. That is true. But that created the context by which we came to the place that we were in August of this year, where the department, in the summer of this year, really, where the department engaged in this specific adoption placement decision. And that's the issue that's on review here. The specific on whether or not the appellant made a prima facie case of this specific adoption placement was unreasonable.
And Ms. Lynch, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Judge Rodenberg. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm looking at AM's affidavit, and it seems to me that AM has set forth everything she could possibly set forth on the subject. That is, the placement of the child with her, the child did well, the other placement outside of her home, it was disrupted. He came back to her, it came back and regressed in some ways. And then there was what more could she have said beyond her 16-page affidavit to have made a prima facie case?
I think what she did in her affidavit was make a prima facie case that it would have been reasonable to place with her. What she needed to show was an unreasonableness in the department's decision-making, and she did not get to that.
Asking my question is, how would she do that if she's included in her affidavit all the facts that she knows or can know? How would she make that unreasonableness? How would she allege facts that show unreasonableness if she doesn't know them?
Because unreasonableness is defined as arbitrary or capricious, to show that the decision itself was arbitrary and capricious, to show, and that would ignore the context of the fact that we were where we were within a lengthy review process and significant numbers of court orders. So I think she would need to get into the specifics of that, and she did not do that.
Ms. Lynch, can I follow up with that? And the LLP made it pretty clear we're following the three-step review, and the court should look just as we do in motion custody motion modifications. And to follow up with what Judge Rodenberg said, how would anyone, I guess, factually here be able to recite why the human services didn't place? All they can do is, here's what's happening in our home and why we think it should be in our home, which is precisely why we're at prima facie basis. My question is more specifically, in a family case, then there might be a responding affidavit, but we'll still assume the moving affidavit to be true other than context. So if we're only looking at context, which is perhaps dates and what happened, and there's been four placements and a court review and delays of an adoption, there's really nothing but this allegation. And so don't we presume that allegation to be true? And if it was reasonable to place there and there's nothing else but context for prima facie basis, that would mean it's unreasonable. And then everybody can submit their evidence to trial. Isn't that the whole purpose of this statutory construction?
No, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. The purpose of the statutory construction is to provide discretion within a robust court oversight to the department in that placing decision, given what's going on for that specific placing decision, which is different than a custody decision, which comes as a separate decision. That's a unique individual decision. This decision is within the context of the court's oversight of the department's unique role in providing, in making its placement decision. So,
but where in the statute that we're looking at do we see that? All we read is, of course, we're reading that a motion must present a prima facie basis that it was unreasonable. And so all we have is the one affidavit.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not, so we're...
Well, you made reference to the purpose as robust court oversight. I don't know that anybody's disputing the court's oversight. It's just that we have the movement's affidavit, which indicated not only how well she's been doing and included allegations that would be harmful to move her. That just seems like we're limited to that, and the court was as well.
But the court did not, unlike an LLP, the court wasn't weighing, the court accepted that, the court accepted those and did not weigh specific allegations about the other side, about the virtues or the positives about the other placement. The court was looking at the context of whether or not the agency's decision was unreasonable, given everything that had gone on with the other orders and the other and this proceeding.
So let me just interrupt you there, because the given what's going on with the other orders, part of it to me sounds like a weighing of evidence, going beyond just context, but an actual weighing of the evidence, considering the relative search that occurred? And isn't that something that under LLP, the court is simply not permitted to do?
I think that LLP though provides a guide where there were specific characteristics of the individuals involved and there was a credibility weighing that happened in LLP that did not happen here. The court accepted the facts that could be contested. The court accepted those on appellant's case as being, you know, that the child did well in her care, that the child had was in a third placement at that point, that the child had suffered some harm and disruption in their earlier placement changes. The court clearly credited all of those things. And the court also, you know, the court then considered, I think with the statutory review regime in 260C605 and 607, you know, creates a continuum for the court to be creating its oversight. And to say that we're gonna take this individual custody decision as simply as the context being simply that affidavit, the appellant's, now appellant's affidavit, ignores that oversight role in the unique process. In a custody case, there's a modification or initial custody motion, and that's sort of the zero point. Here, the zero point needs to consider the context of that oversight structure.
I guess one question I have is, how is a court supposed to perform its oversight function when you know, there's only one side of the story that is evident? I mean, isn't that the purpose of an evidentiary hearing?
So the purpose of an evidentiary hearing is to provide oversight. I think, no, the purpose is to review the progress towards adoption. And it's clear that continuing to have contested adoption proceedings does delay the progress towards adoption. So in this case, the agency was making a placement that moves the case towards adoption. And that's the issue.
Is it significant that the district court seems to have thought the original or earlier relative search to have been the county's search to have been less than ideal, and noting that it should have been more comprehensive at the beginning? Ought we to consider that now in light of AM's affidavit as indicating some showing of unreasonableness?
I think we consider the fact of the court's previous orders, and that there were orders to reopen to continue with relative search efforts, and one order to reopen the relative search effort. I think that that is within the court's oversight. 260C605 provides for, you know, specific venues to reopen to look at the department's relative search efforts. The statute clearly is designed to avoid contesting every fact that's gone on previous to it unless necessary. So that's where that's why appellant does not need to show the reasonableness of her position, but needs to show the unreasonableness of the department's decision making process. Well, so there is a preference to continue on.
The reason I asked the question that way is, it seems as if, as I earlier went through it, AM has submitted an affidavit that says all she knows about the child's best interests. And then the district court says that it did what it did because the county didn't do a sufficiently comprehensive relative search at the outset. Don't those two things in combination make at least a prima facie showing
of unreasonableness? No, and the department takes seriously the oversight function of the district court, and does have the opportunity. If the department thought the district court had abused its discretion in its earlier orders, the department could have sought relief, and the department did not do that. To seek that relief would have delayed the progress towards adoption in a different way. Granted, there was a delay here by the orders for repeated by the two sets of orders that continue with the relative search process, but the department accepts and takes seriously that oversight function and continued to work on the relative search process. And again, appellant's affidavit makes a convincing, I think a good case for the idea that placing with her would have been reasonable, but that doesn't create the opposite. So it's, we need to look at where we are now and in August of 2020, where what's going on. The previous history, of placing with appellant is not dispositive. And to open everything and require the department to essentially address everything at each phase is clearly contrary to the statutory regime.
Mr. Fidler is arguing that the previous agreement to place with AM was dispositive. I heard him to argue that that creates a fact question appropriate for trial.
Then there would always be a trial. I mean, if appellant wants a trial, and I think that there is designed to be a gatekeeper function to have trials, and we have them in Hennepin County. Mr. Fidler knows about that. It's not that they don't happen, but there is designed to be a gatekeeper function to avoid the disruption and and most importantly, the delay in moving the case forward to adoption.
Ms. Lynch, can I just follow up with that? It seems like this is actually fairly unique, at least it struck me that we have a child about 80 or 90% of the time over 4 years in a home that the county for about almost the same percentage of time believed it was in the best interest and should be adopted. And in my career on the bench, I don't know that I ever had such a scenario. It's typically a relative wanting to intervene on adoption outside the home seemed the more common one. So you mentioned that we'd have trial in every case. It seems like, again, it's fairly limited. The affidavit fairly well identified as well as one could. Did I misunderstand what you said, Ms. Lynch?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I do think that there is clearly a sorting function designed to focus on and give a preference to the agency's placing decision. And I do agree that this is unusual, perhaps in the particular format, but again, we need to look at what happened in August of 2020 and what the department's decision was in August of 2020 with all of the facts before it, which were at that point two, and this is in the affidavit, which were approved home studies of these relatives. So I think I don't know if that was in the affidavit, but the affidavit clearly talked about the awareness of the relatives and what had gone on with the previous relatives and what had happened that brought us to the phase of August 2020. So if having court orders means we're always going to have a trial, that vitiates the oversight function. It creates too much opportunity for delay, and the statute was designed to move things forward. This is complicated, and I'm sorry, I can see that I'm over my time, but this is complicated, and again, I do think that an opposite decision, if the court had found that there was a prima facie case, that would be sustainable. I think that does not mean that the court's decision was wrong in this case. The court focused on the statutory language, used unreasonableness, did not reach for an unnecessary statutory interpretation, which is what appellant really needs to get to in order to move us forward here. And the court did not make fact assessments, did not make credibility assessments. The court looked at what was before it and determined that there was not a need for an evidentiary hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lynch. And Mr. Fidler, you will now have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. I wanted to bring the court right back to the text of the statute. And if you look at 260C 607 sub 6E, it talks about the evidentiary phase. So there's a two-part process, right? There's prima facie, and then there's the evidentiary phase. And that language is so telling because what it does is it explicitly links the test of unreasonableness with the best interest factors under 260C 212 subdivision 2. And there, it says, if the court finds the agency has been unreasonable in failing to make the placement and that the relative is most suitable, whatever, the court may order the agency to make the placement. So that I would submit that and it's not a disjunctive and, it's a conjunctive and. So that means that unreasonableness, a finding of let me flip it around. A finding that placement is in the best interest of the child, we have put in evidence of that. I think that implicitly makes the decision to not place with my client unreasonable.
Couldn't the opposite be true though, Mr. Fidler? I mean, couldn't it be argued that the best interests of the child are only factored in once the appellant gets past that initial evidentiary hurdle of making a prima facie case of unreasonableness?
I don't know how somebody like appellant AM could ever show unreasonableness. Judge Rodenberg.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think you can show unreasonableness applying the definition that the district court gave to the word here? In other words, did the district court abuse its discretion in finding that the agency's actions were not arbitrary and capricious?
Yeah, no, I think you can adopt the court's reasoning, but you have to adopt it in conjunction with an analysis of the best interest test. So would it be arbitrary to decide reasonableness without considering the best interest of the child? I think that would be arbitrary. Would it be unguided by reason to find, oh, the county is unreasonable and never look at the best interest of the child test? I think that would be unguided by reason. Would it be irrational to find, well, the relative is more suitable without ever looking at the best interests of the child factors? I think that would be unreasonable. So that shows that the reasonableness and the best interests of the child factors are inextricably combined, and they have to be considered together. And, you know, the county talks about there's a robust oversight function. Well, I have to disagree, because appellant, you know, had her 16-page affidavit. She had a 41-page filing altogether with expert evidence showing that this removal would be disastrous for the child. And she had an adoptive placement agreement. We had the county coming to our adoption hearing and saying that they had no objection to the court finalizing the adoption. Just think about that. So they were there actually implicitly in support of our adoption petition. And the only reason that we didn't get to adopt is because there was an extrajudicial hold put on the adoption petition by a judge who appellant was never a party in front of. She was never a party in that case, never appeared. And yet there was that judge put a hold on the adoption petition. So if appellant can't make a case under these facts, nobody can. And then what you have is exactly what was contemplated in the Fleming case. They said it would give the commissioner an arbitrary power, which if he chose to, would leave no redress to the parties who had cared for and supported the child during the supervisory period, under the impression at least that they could eventually adopt her. Arbitrary power to the commissioner. And we think that is what, frankly, this court would be inviting if it upholds the opinion of the court below. And therefore, we'd ask the court to reverse and just simply order a trial. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your briefing as well as your answers to our questions today. We will be taking the matter under advisement in the expedited form because it's a child protection related matter. And happy holidays to both of you. And we will now adjourn from our three oral arguments.